Chapter 17. Ron Paul, A Man for This Season. There is one presidential candidate I happen to like a lot, and that's Ron Paul. He's a veteran of 35 years in the U.S. Congress who's already run for president twice, 1988 as the Libertarian Party's candidate and 2008 as a Republican. We have interviewed him on multiple occasions for my TV show. The great thing about him is that whatever question you ask, he'll do his best to give an honest answer. There's generally no relationship today between elected officials and the public, but Ron Paul will at least talk to you, which is why so many young people also think so highly of him. When he had a counter-convention in St. Paul, where I spoke a few years ago, we didn't have any more security than you do for any Target Center event. Ron Paul isn't afraid, and in my view, he's a true man of the people. So I came out publicly last December and endorsed him hands down as my choice for president. That's because I want somebody who's going to change the direction of the country, a leader who will follow the Constitution and who believes in states' rights, and somebody who will shock the status quo. At the end of 2007, on the 234th anniversary of the Boston Tea Party, Paul showed up in Freeport, Texas, where organizers of a nationwide fundraiser had some barrels waiting for him to dump into the Brazos River. He passed by the ones that said United Nations and IRS and threw one marked Iraq War into the water. Under the slogan Liberty is Brewing, in a single day the new Tea Party raised over $6 million. This was before the movement really came together 2 years later and got co-opted by the billionaires. Paul's campaign literature justifiably calls him Godfather of the Tea Party. But, like the man says, I think parties are pretty irrelevant. Have you ever noticed that we change parties sometimes, but the policies never change? He's accused Newt Gingrich of serial hypocrisy, and that's one thing that can't be said about Paul. He's always been a straight shooter. My sincere hope is that once he gets passed over by the Republican gang, and no matter how well he did in the primaries, he will be, he'll pull a John Anderson and bolt from the fold. If Paul runs as an independent or with the Libertarian Party, he'll absolutely get my vote. I might even consider joining him on the ticket if he asked me to. I've been quoting from our paper of record, the New York Times, a lot in this book, along with my critique of their coverage in the chapter on media. This next one really pissed me off. An editorial they did called Mr. Paul's Discredited Campaign. It began, Ron Paul long ago disqualified himself for the presidency by peddling claptrap proposals like abolishing the Federal Reserve, returning to the gold standard, cutting a third of the federal budget and all foreign aid, and opposing the Civil Rights Act of 1964. For one thing, much of that was a long time ago, since he's been elected to 10 terms in the U.S. House of Representatives since 1976. And tell me, who else has stood up as strongly to the money powers? Congressman Paul gathered bipartisan support to get a bill passed that, for the first time, brought about an audit of the Federal Reserve and revealed the trillions in taxpayer money doled out secretly to the banks as their reward for screwing over the American people. He'd earlier written a book called End the Fed. During his years in the Congress, Paul has often been the lone naysayer on legislation that he doesn't think is constitutional, leading some in Congress to call him Dr. No. His wife thinks they've got the spelling wrong. He's Dr. No, K-N-O-W. Contrast this to Gingrich, who, when asked how he planned to address the Federal Reserve, said, "Well, let's see, sir, ma'am." Not cute, Newt. Here's one of the New York Times op-ed columnists, Ross Douthat, on Paul. In both the 2008 and 2012 campaigns, Paul has been the only figure willing to point out the deep continuities in American politics, the way social spending grows and overseas commitments multiply, no matter which party is in power, the revolving doors that connect K Street to Congress and Wall Street to the White House, the long list of dubious policies and programs that both sides tacitly support. In both election cycles, his honest extremism has sometimes cut closer to the heart of our national predicament than the calculating partisanship of his more grounded rivals. He sometimes rants, but he rarely spins, and he's one of the few figures on the national stage who says a plague on both your houses and actually means it. Ron Paul is also the only presidential candidate, Republican or Democrat, who says we spend far too much on the military and have no business invading other countries. He believes that the Department of Defense should do just that, defensive, not offensive, literally and figuratively, foreign wars. Think of how much money pulling out of these messes would save. But aside from Rick Perry, who flew C-130s in the Air Force, Paul is the only candidate who actually did military service. He was a flight surgeon in the Air Force, and then part of its National Guard in the 60s. The last great military leader we had as president, Dwight D. Eisenhower, was also the president who warned us about the military-industrial complex and called for cutting the Pentagon budget. Seems it's always the chicken hawks who want to spend more money. Throughout our history, the majority of our ex-presidents, 31 altogether out of 47, have been part of our country's military at some point. But presuming neither Perry nor Paul ends up a candidate, this will be the first time in 68 years that a presidential race has been between two non-veterans. And one of those will be Commander-in-Chief, in charge of overseeing our war in Afghanistan and who knows what else. Who do you think had by far the most donations of any candidate from our men and women in uniform? Between September 2011 and January 2012, Paul received $95,000 in individual donations from current and former members of the military. Obama came in second with around $72,000. Last year's total for Paul was 10 times more than Romney raised and 100 times more than Gingrich. Newt used college deferments to avoid the draft during Vietnam, but now promises he would strike foes at the slightest provocation. Toward the end of February, several hundred troops held a rally outside the White House in support of Paul. One of the signs read, "Don't let anybody make you think that God chose America to be a policeman of the whole world." And Paul is the one his nutty opponents are calling crazy. He says that we shouldn't have invaded Iraq, and we sure as hell shouldn't invade Iran. He seems to appreciate that young men actually get killed in these wars that sound so good when politicians spout off in their speeches and debates and declare mission accomplished. Not only does Paul find our warmongering ways to be draining the country dry, and has called for the immediate removal of our troops not only from Iraq, but also from Afghanistan and military bases around the world, he isn't afraid to come right out and talk about blowback. By that, he means that what's been called our nation's invade, bomb, and occupy first, ask questions later doctrine results in more likely terrorist retaliation, not less. As Paul says succinctly, we have an empire. We can't afford it. We thought Obama might help us and get us out of some of these messes. But now we're in more countries than ever. We can't even keep track of how many places our troops are. Today we have military personnel in 156 countries and bases in 63 countries. In 2010 alone, the U.S. spent $728 billion on the military. That's about 45% of the world's $1.6 trillion total, six times more than number two spender China. Here's another crazy Ron Paul idea. To me, foreign aid is taking money from poor people in this country and giving it to rich people in poor countries, and it becomes weapons of war. He's been accused of being anti-Israel, but here's what he actually has said. Stop and consider America's policy. We give $3 billion a year to Israel in loans, and we give $12 billion or more in assistance to Israel's self-declared enemies. Some of these are countries that say they will drive Israel into the sea. We should be their friend and their trading partner. They are a democracy, and we share many values with them. But we should not be their master. We should not dictate where their borders will be, nor should we have veto power over their foreign policy. Our aid in the region is out of balance, and it is wrong. Foreign aid does not help Israel. It is a net disadvantage. Paul isn't afraid to bring up the still taboo subject of Cuba either. When I was governor in 2002, I went there on a trade mission that the Bush administration tried to stop. Otto Reich, who was Bush's State Department top dog for the Western Hemisphere, even came out publicly saying he hoped my group wasn't going to Cuba to sample the sex trade. I demanded an apology from the administration, but of course it was never forthcoming. Anyway, I even had an audience with Fidel Castro, which you can learn about in my book, Don't Start the Revolution Without Me, and I sure came away believing it was way past time to lift our economic embargo and open up relations again with our neighbor 90 miles to the south. 10 years later, you still had Newt Gingrich saying at a debate in Florida that U.S. policy should be aggressively to overthrow the regime and to do everything we can to support those Cubans who want freedom. Was that a soundbite from 50 years ago, Newt? Addressing Cuban citizens, Rick Santorum called for sanctions to continue until they had gotten rid of these tyrants who have controlled you for these 50-plus years. He also said, in all seriousness, that if Cuba were China, in terms of where it was situated, he'd be just as against it. The only voice of sanity has been Ron Paul, who put it like this. I think it's time to quit this isolation business of not talking to people. We talked to the Soviets. We talked to the Chinese. And we opened up trade, and we're not killing each other now. We fought with the Vietnamese for a long time. We finally gave up, started talking to them. Now we trade with them. I don't know why the Cuban people should be so intimidating. I think we're living in the dark ages when we can't even talk to the Cuban people. I think it's not 1962 anymore, and we don't have to use force and intimidation and overthrow of governments. I just don't think that's going to work. Ron Paul also had the guts to say in a debate back in 2008 that the 9/11 attacks were the Muslim world's response to our military's machinations around the world. When Rudy Giuliani demanded he take that back, Paul refused. Paul has also asserted that after 9/11, immediately before there was any assessment, there was glee in the Bush administration because now we can invade Iraq. Anyway, we're supposedly out of there now, almost 9 years later, and look at the results. About $1 trillion of U.S. taxpayers' money spent or approved. $9 billion of taxpayers' money lost and unaccounted for. Number of U.S. troops killed, 4,487. Number of U.S. troops wounded, 32,226. Number of U.S. troops returning with serious mental health problems, 30% within their first few months back home. The Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America group has estimated that nearly 1 in 3 deployed over there suffer from PTSD, depression, or traumatic brain injury. Altogether, we deployed 1.5 million to Iraq, so you do the math. Number of Iraqi insurgents killed, 55,000, rough estimate. Number of Iraqi civilians killed, more than 100,000, according to a secret U.S. government report released by WikiLeaks. Some estimates put the figure at more than 600,000. Hell of a liberation, and this doesn't take into account how the Pentagon can't seem to locate documents explaining whatever it spent $1.7 billion on out of money from the frozen assets of Saddam Hussein supposedly being held by the New York Federal Reserve on behalf of Iraq's people. The DOD just can't find the spreadsheets after conducting multiple electronic database searches, along with looking through 100 boxes of files. A report by the Pentagon's Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction concludes this is just a problem of record management. Also unexplained is whatever happened to over $100 million in cash that was being kept at Saddam's old palace in Baghdad during the course of the war. Young people most of all like Ron Paul, just like they did Howard Dean. He doesn't play the game and he says what he thinks. Paul enjoys a huge amount of popularity among young voters despite the fact that at 76, he's by far the oldest candidate out there. I guess the youth haven't been brainwashed yet by the gangster media. We don't really know how much the Democrat-leaning ones are for Paul because they don't get polled about him. But a Gallup poll taken among Republican-leaning voters last January found that 31% between the ages of 18 to 34 preferred Paul as the candidate, compared to 26% for Romney. Early on, Paul came in a close third in the Iowa caucuses thanks to their support. The only age group Romney won was 65 and older, the exit polling said. Then look at what happened with Maine's 2012 caucuses in February. The chairman of that state's Republican Party is Charles Webster, who spent months cooking up voter fraud to dissuade thousands of out-of-state students from going to the polls. These young people spend most of the year attending colleges in Maine, and the state's Republican Secretary of State, Charles E. Summers Jr., investigated Webster's so-called evidence and found it to be completely bogus. It goes against federal law, too, As if this wasn't bad enough, Webster declared Mitt Romney the winner of the Maine caucuses, even though three different counties hadn't yet had their votes counted. Paul, it was claimed, lost by 194 votes to Romney. The corporate media would have you believe that Paul's popularity with young people is all about smoking weed, because Paul supports legislation that would allow any state that chooses to legalize marijuana. Come on, that's an easy stereotype. The war on drugs, he's rightly said, is a total failure, adding that it undermines our civil liberties, it magnifies the problems on the borders. We spent over the last 40 years $1 trillion on this war, and believe me, the kids can still get the drugs. It hasn't worked. The fact is, Paul stands against crony capitalism and our imperial wars, and what's happening simultaneously to our civil liberties are what a lot of younger people admire. He also is a staunch opponent of the death penalty. Rich white people don't get the death penalty very often, Paul points out. On the immigration issue, he rejects the idea of barbed wire fences and guns on our border. As for abolishing the Federal Reserve, what's wrong with the idea of taking away the power from a secret group of individuals to print money at will? The thing that's ultimately so appealing about Paul is that he's managed to keep his integrity and stay outside the party line bullshit. Here's what a 22-year-old computer programmer in Seattle, Andrew Pilloud, said about Paul. The fundamental emotional response to Paul is the same as Obama in 2008. He is the candidate for change. I personally think he's more likely to bring around change than Obama was. Once he gets into the White House, he's going to do less compromising of his principles. Another fellow, 21-year-old Carlos Alfaro of Arizona State University, said, I think because students were so involved in the 2008 election, they were also really involved in seeing what went wrong. They felt that betrayal. Now he's a Paul supporter. So is Justin Clements, a 21-year-old finance major at the University of Washington. He thinks Paul's economic platform really resonates with the youth. Paul is saying, look, we need to take control of our future because it's been squandered and gambled by previous generations. Some other students take it a step further. What Ron Paul's campaign has really shown us is that the two-party system isn't sustainable for much longer, according to Ryan Neal, a 24-year-old from Columbia University. Added Pilloud, we have two parties that both stand for different factions of the elite. And here is Stephen Silvestri, a 24-year-old New York waiter who's behind Paul, and said, I'm just really sick of Republicans and Democrats. They're part of the same money-grubbing game. On February 18, 2011, while bigwig Missouri and Kansas Republicans were feasting on steak at conventions not far away, Paul had a rally that drew a couple thousand to Kansas City's Union Station, including a few who snuck away from the fancier banquet. They stood and chanted while Paul talked about how our country went off track. We've slipped away from a true republic, he said. Now we're slipping into a fascist system where it's a combination of government and big business and authoritarian rule and the suppression of the individual rights of each and every American citizen. More than once, he slammed Obama for signing a law that could put anybody suspected of association with Al-Qaeda or similar terrorism to be put in military custody. Name me any other candidate willing to go out on these kinds of limbs. The powers that be are actually pretty terrified of Ron Paul, and justifiably so. For 2 years running, by a big margin, he'd come out on top in a straw poll of those attending the yearly Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC. In this election year, the organizers didn't want to take the chance that Paul might do it again. They switched away from paper ballots to electronic voting, which you could do from a computer or handheld device. The American Conservative Union's current president, El Cardenas, was up front about the reason. In the past, he said, to his credit, about 80, 90, 100% of people who were there and liked Ron Paul voted, and probably a very small percentage of those who liked others bothered to vote. By shifting to the quicker voting method, rather than manual counting, and letting members vote whenever they wanted during the conference, the hope was that another candidate besides Paul would carry the banner. To his credit, Paul didn't bother to attend. I can't leave out the fact that Paul was a real comrade in arms with my lawsuit against the Transportation Security Administration, TSA, that does the screening at our airports. Late in 2010, he introduced the American Traveler Dignity Act in Congress, talking frankly about how the real problem is that the American people have been too submissive. Paul also said, "Can you think how silly the whole thing is? The pilot has a gun in the cockpit, and he's managing this aircraft, which is a missile, and we make him go through this groping X-ray exercise, having people feeling their underwear? It's absurd, and it's time we wake up." Paul went on to make some powerful points about what's happened over the decade since about 3,000 people died on 9/11. Since that time, we have also lost 6,000 of our military personnel going over there and trying to rectify this problem. We have lost 400,000 people on our government-run highways. We have lost 150,000 people from homicides. We're not dealing with it the right way. Groping people at the airport doesn't solve our problems. The lock on the door and the gun inside the cockpit were the greatest boon to our safety. Let the private sector, preferably the airlines themselves, provide for the security for their property, is the way Paul sees it. Here's the thing about Paul. It's about the issue, not the gang ideology. He and the American Civil Liberties Union have worked together in the past. In 2009, the ACLU sued the Transportation Security Administration on behalf of a staffer for Ron Paul's nonprofit organization, Campaign for Liberty, who was briefly detained in an airport after hesitating to explain why he was carrying a box of cash. He pointed to Dennis Kucinich, the liberal Ohio congressman, as being an ally on civil liberties and foreign policy. Paul also has a unique strategy in terms of getting delegate support at the convention. It's perfectly within the rules set up by the system. His people are focusing on the states with caucuses instead of winner-take-all or proportional primaries, states like Iowa, Colorado, Nevada, Minnesota, and Maine. The rules vary from state to state, but after each precinct votes, they select delegates to go to county conventions, which in turn choose a smaller number for the state levels. It's those county and state-level conventions that end up picking the national convention delegates. Who they're going to support doesn't have to be announced ahead of time. What Paul's campaign has done is get his precinct-level people to volunteer to be county convention delegates in hopes they will outnumber the other guys when push comes to shove. At the national level, a winning candidate needs to have 1,144 out of the 2,286 delegates attending the convention. Let's say neither Romney or Santorum can hit the magic number. That's when Paul's quiet army of caucus delegates becomes important. He could end up winning a state's delegate count even though he didn't top the popular vote. Modern conventions are supposed to be highly organized, tightly controlled displays of popular unity, as one forecaster put it. At the very least, a successful Paul delegate strategy could shatter that prospect. And that is democracy in action. Nah, 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 nah. I'm not saying I agree with Ron Paul down the line on everything, but why should I have to? Right now, he's about it among politicians willing to speak truth to power. So I have to agree with what's on the T-shirts among his volunteer workers. Ron Paul rocks America, and with the pro-Paul pop songs they play over the loudspeakers at his rallies. Ron Paul, start a revolution and break down illegal institutions. To sum it up, Chuck Baldwin, who Paul endorsed as an independent running in 08, says this about him. Dr. Paul knows the Constitution. He has studied it. He has read what America's founding fathers and framers have written about the Constitution. He has studied the Enlightenment philosophers, theologians, and teachers, you know, the same ones that Thomas Jefferson and James Madison studied. He knows that the reason America is in the mess it is in today is because the Constitution has been abandoned. And he also knows that the only way to fix it politically is to return to constitutional governance. Therefore, when Dr. Paul talks about drugs, foreign policy, military adventurism, or even social issues, he does so from a constitutional point of reference. And the Constitution is clear when it comes to these matters. Domestic drug laws are the exclusive responsibility of the states, as is virtually every other law enforcement matter. foreign entanglements, empire building, turning our military personnel into the world's policemen, etc., are all anathema to constitutional government. And the longer our political leaders continue to ignore the Constitution, the more America will continue to slide down this slippery slope in which we now find ourselves. Chapter 18. Where do we go from here? A call for a no-party system. Our country's distrust of government has reached its highest level ever. In December 2011, USA Today came out with an analysis of voter registration statistics state by state. Where voters get registered by party affiliation, Democrats were on the downswing in 25 of the 28 states, all told by 800,000 people. Republicans declined in 21 states by about 350,000 people. But independents were on the increase in 18 states, gaining 325,000 people. States with big increases along independent lines were Florida, North Carolina, Colorado. The elections director in North Carolina said that he thinks the winner in 2012 will be whoever is attractive to the unaffiliated voter. George Washington, mind you, set the example. He was elected as an independent before any parties existed. Besides Washington, two other presidents, John Tyler and Andrew Jackson, switched to independent while in office. At the state level, we've already seen a shift. In governor's races in recent years, independent and third-party candidates have won in Connecticut, Maine, Alaska, and Rhode Island, as well as Minnesota, of course. In 2010, independent candidates also beat out major party nominees in races for the Senate in Colorado and Florida. And you've got to know there's something in the wind when the very strategist in charge of Bush's campaign ads in 2000 and 2004, Mark McKinnon, now says he's interested in anything that disrupts the current system. Given the dissatisfaction sweeping the nation, one of the strongest manifestations of democracy activism has been the recall movement. Right now, only 19 states allow recalls of elected officials through petition drives. But in 2011, at least 150 officials in 17 different states faced recall votes. That total included 30 mayors and 11 state legislators, 9 in Wisconsin, where Scott Walker is now the third governor in U.S. history looking at a recall vote. This is a sure sign that more and more voters are ready to throw the bums out. Besides the recalls, there are other signs of a shift. Bernie Sanders, the independent U.S. senator from Vermont, has called for a constitutional amendment to overturn the Supreme Court ruling that declared corporations to be persons and opened wide the door for no restrictions on secret campaign spending. What had happened was a complete undermining of democracy, in Sanders' terms, and a century-long ban on corporate donations needed to be enforced. You'd need a two-thirds majority in the two houses of Congress and ratification by three-quarters of the 50 states to make the amendment happen, and I, for one, am enthused about it. It was also heartening to see that the Montana Supreme Court went against the Citizens United ruling by putting back in place the state's century-long ban on corporate direct spending on candidates or committees. Most promising of all, the citizenry is coming together around this. In January 2011, petitions with more than 750,000 signatures were delivered to Congress, calling for the constitutional amendment to reverse this decision. In January 2012, over 350 protest events were held around the nation. In February, 50 grassroots organizations sent letters to the House and Senate Judiciary Committees demanding hearings on the need to change this. Right now, we'd also need a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Electoral College, an action that a Gallup poll showed 62% of Americans are in favor of doing. For the first time, Republican voters joined Democrats and independents in saying that the popular vote ought to decide presidential elections. The Electoral College was created during the Constitutional Convention in 1787, intended to bring some stability to the 13 states where communication and travel were slow. It was a horse and buggy idea that has long outlived its time. The Electoral College is not only antiquated, it's undemocratic. The most powerful elected official we have is the only one not required to have the most votes to win. Supposedly, in our democracy, every voter should have equal representation, but that's hardly the case. Campaigning for president pretty much now goes on in a few big swing states. If you happen to live in Ohio or Florida, where the race is bound to be close, you're disproportionately important. A little rural town in Podunk, Ohio becomes more important than a big city like, well, Minneapolis. Not to mention that these swing states are where the most venal corruption takes place. The Supreme Court stealing Florida for Bush in 2000, and the electronic voting machine stealing Ohio for Bush in 2004. The 2000 election actually marked the fourth time in our history that the man who won the most votes lost the presidential election, starting with Andrew Jackson in 1824, lost to John Quincy Adams, then Samuel Tilden in 1876, lost to Rutherford B. Hayes, Grover Cleveland in 1888, lost to Benjamin Harrison, and Al Gore in 2000 to Bush. Look, in Article 2 of the Constitution, the founders guaranteed that if a state thinks it should give its electors to the national winner of the popular vote, they've got every right to do so. And states representing 132 votes in the Electoral College have gone forward to enact national popular vote legislation, pledging that whichever candidate comes in first among the people nationwide will get all their electors. You only need 270 total in the Electoral College to win an election. This is part of a national popular vote movement, whereby the Electoral College would continue to exist but could be superseded without going through trying to amend the Constitution. Through an interstate compact, participating states agree ahead of time to automatically give their electoral votes to whomever takes the national popular vote, not who gains the majority in their own state. So far, 8 state legislatures have passed laws endorsing this, along with the District of Columbia. The latest to sign on was California. See www.nationalpopularvote.com for more. The Heritage Foundation says, oh no, this would diminish the influence of smaller states and rural areas and encourage voter fraud and radicalize American politics. Excuse me. But didn't the Republicans, who are supported by the Heritage Foundation, already do that? Isn't the crux of the matter whether every person's vote should count for something? Some new and, I think, very creative ideas are being proposed. In August 2011, the chairman and CEO of Starbucks, Howard Schultz, sent out a long email to everyone in his company. He wrote of being frustrated about the lack of cooperation and irresponsibility among elected officials as they have put partisan agendas before the people's agenda. The response to the boss's email astonished him with its support. Schultz then called on people to basically go on strike against all the politicians and stop making contributions to their campaigns. It's a sad state of affairs that the only thing they'll listen to is money, he said, but given that fact, it was time to force Washington's hand with a boycott. The new means of communication can begin to allow candidates to bypass party and big donations. That's what Howard Dean got going back in 2004, and Obama followed up to some degree in 08. Now there's a for-profit political startup called Ruck.us, founded by 2 sons of politicians, Ray Glendening and Nathan Daschle, who believe the 2 parties have simply failed to keep pace with today's world. Their idea is to internet connect people around collective action, beyond whatever party or political ideas they have. So you go to their website, sign up, and pick out what issues matter to you. You end up with a ruck, meaning the 50, 100, or 250 folks who have similar viewpoints. Then you're linked up to a communication feed to find out what your ruck is talking about and what actions they're involved in. Daschle, the younger, has said Ruck.us takes the core features of political engagement, matching like-minded people, and then allowing them to exchange information and take collective action and rebuilds them. Political parties have held a monopoly on these features for the last 200 years. Thanks to social media technology, that's no longer the case. It is not a third party, it's anti-party. It challenges the deeper premise of whether parties are even necessary in the 21st century. So far, Students First, Live Strong, and Rock the Vote have partnered with Ruck.us for reaching out to their own audiences. Until you scratch the surface, another internet-based effort toward a third choice for president seems interesting. That's Americans Elect, which, as of November 2011, had raised $22 million toward having several rounds of internet voting and then holding a nonpartisan nominating convention online in June, with any registered voter able to take part. These delegates will end up nominating a presidential ticket that includes one Republican and one Democrat, with the goal of being on the ballot in every state. Pretty ambitious, but as of Christmas 2011, the nonprofit group had already gotten onto the ballot in a dozen states, including California, in the swing states of Nevada, Colorado, Ohio, Michigan, and Florida, and they'd collected signatures in 17 more states that allow this process before an election. The New York Times' Thomas Friedman, a bighorn tutor for globalization in the past, has come out and said excitedly, "What Amazon.com did to books, what the blogosphere did to newspapers, what the iPod did to music, what drugstore.com did to pharmacies, Americans Elect plans to do to the two-party duopoly that has dominated American political life. Remove the barriers to real competition, flatten the incumbents, and let the people in." Okay, all well and good, even though I don't even do email. The problem is Americans Elect is one of those social welfare groups that don't have to divulge anything about their donors, thanks to the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision. Those who have dug into it, though, have learned that they've gotten some prime real estate for offices in New York and D.C., financed with some serious hedge fund money. The group's board chair, Peter Ackerman, is an investment banker who's pumped in more than $1 million of his own wealth after being a switch-hitter donator over the years to both existing gangs. Ackerman has also sat on a Cato Institute board that wanted to privatize Social Security. He used to be director of capital markets at Drexel Burnham Lambert, the outfit made infamous by Michael Milken. Other funders have been reported as hailing from Lakeside Capital Partners, the Mount Vernon Group Investment Fund, and the Promotion Marketing Association. American Elect's bylaws state that any ticket chosen by the Internet Convention must then get approval from the group's Candidate Certification Committee, CCC, to make sure that the ticket has gang members responsive to the vast majority of citizens while remaining independent of special interests and the partisan interests of either major political party. The board members appoint the CCC. Recently, Americans Elect loosened the rules to allow a majority vote of the delegates to override their decision. But beware of Greeks bearing gifts is one way to look at this whole business. My question is, why the secrecy? Americans Elect has said it's needed because its underwriters fear retaliation for challenging the political status quo. Except those underwriters may be among the hidden undertakers for American democracy. The group's top strategist, Douglas Schoen, has advised the Democrats on the side to keep a distance from the dangerously out-of-touch Occupy Wall Streeters. When it comes to parties, the true Libertarian Party, not to be confused with the Tea Party, whose end result would be feudalism, is the party most aligned with our Constitution. The Constitution is still the greatest document ever written for the benefit of mankind, which has held the Republic together better than anything the world has known. If followed fully to its principles of free trade, a small, transparent, and compassionate government, maximum personal liberty, and non-intervention in foreign conflicts, our country would still be the most prosperous and least indebted nation on earth. So let's go back again to a time when democracy was alive and well. Here's John Adams. "There's nothing which I dread so much as a division of the Republic into two great parties, each arranged under its leader, and concerting measures in opposition to each other. This, in my humble apprehension, is to be dreaded as the greatest political evil under our Constitution." Remember, John Adams is a guy who defended the British in court after the Boston Massacre because that's how much he believed in the system he was trying to create. That wasn't a popular thing. The equivalent today was Dick Cheney going after the lawyers who are defending the Gitmo detainees. Cheney would call Adams a traitor for defending these enemies of our nation. But if our nation is going to stand for anything, then you do defend your enemies. Do you ever find it ironic that a country that espouses freedom of choice offers only two real choices in our presidential politics? What if we were instructed to make our selection between two cars or two shirts, or two sizes for our families. There are only a handful of two-party democracies on our entire planet. Besides ours, Japan, Jamaica, and Malta qualify, with Spain and England dominated by a pair but not utterly beholden. Most of the other democracies all have multiple parties. But if there's one thing our own Crips and Bloods agree on, as we've seen earlier in this book, it's to keep themselves the only game in town no matter what. We just had a major election a few years ago that was run on the concept of change we can believe in. Sorry, I don't believe. Where is it? Both parties tell you they're gonna give you something different, but in the end it's all about them. So my proposal is a no-party system. Allow me to quote George Washington once again for a little backup. However, political parties may now and then answer popular ends, they are likely, in the course of time and things, to become potent engines by which cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men will be enabled to subvert the power of the people and to usurp for themselves the reins of government. Parties could still exist, the founders acknowledge that, but only to the point of being no different than any other entity or endorser. If a certain candidate gets backed by the Democratic Party, fine, but you don't put the affiliation next to the name on the ballot. Make all our elections nonpartisan. That way the public has to learn who you are, if you follow me. Let candidates inform voters based on their positions, not these ridiculous stereotypes like, I'm a Republican and therefore I stand up for family values, or I'm a Democrat and so I'm fighting for the working man. It's up to you, the voter, to know which candidate has which endorsements. Then, if you're a Crip or a Blood, you have every right to vote that way. But at least the gang's colors or emblem would not be on the official ballot. You wouldn't stand there in the booth and pull the lever for a whole column of candidates from one party. You'd have to be more involved in the process. Look at what's happening. I mean, how can each member of an entire political party so consistently vote exactly the same way on every kind of issue? It's impossible for that many free-thinking humans to vote alike, unless they're controlled by something other than their own minds. Such monolithic behavior ought to be a tip-off to fraud and betrayal. Without the two gangs pumping millions into local races, wouldn't congressional elections be more local and more about qualifications than who's got the do-re-mi? Eliminate parties, and no longer would committee assignments in Congress be parceled out because of seniority or party loyalty. There'd be no majority and minority. Today, with redistricting, less than 10% of all federal elections are even competitive. Because the parties control the districts, they know who's going to win ahead of time. It's all within the two gangs. Did you ever think about what a difference it might make if our representatives in Congress didn't sit together by party affiliation, but had to sit geographically, or maybe even alphabetically? There's a new group called No Labels that wants to do away with partisan seating, among its 12-point action plan. Why do you need groups within the Senate and the House? You pass laws by a majority vote, first in the Senate and then in the House. It is what it is. If the measure gets more votes, it passes. Otherwise, it fails. But no one is given the title of being a Democrat or Republican anymore. When they get up, they speak as John Smith, senator from Wyoming or wherever. Eliminate the gang connotation. They will still probably be loosely part of the gang, but you're taking a huge step in helping to destroy the stranglehold on power that the gangs control by forcing them to run without a party. Just think, no more dumb polls telling us how the different gangs view the different issues. You don't necessarily need campaign finance limits, though you could go with structured limits on donations. I would say equally to be looked at is full open disclosure of where every penny contributed comes from. You'd no longer have hidden money that could be contributed to the gang, which can then do things that are unaccounted for. This way you put the entire onus onto the campaign committee of a particular candidate. This is how you beat what the Supreme Court did. Corporations can give, but the candidate must run with open disclosure. He or she is completely responsible and nobody else. So if somebody accepts $50 million from the oil companies, he or she has to disclose that completely. Then the public would know, well, guess who's going to have this guy's ear? And you could say, okay, I'm going to vote for someone else whom they haven't paid off. Now, if they end up paying off all the candidates, then you're stuck with who you're stuck with. But we get back to the personal responsibility of the voter, and until that responsibility is exercised, we're barking up a tree. You're still going to get these knuckleheads who get in the booth and say, I'm just going to vote for whatever name I like the best. Fine, but at least you're not voting over which gang you like the best. Even if you pick people randomly, that'd be more honest. Another situation that should be dealt with is these party caucus staffs paid for by our general tax dollars. I am an independent, and always have been. Why should a portion of my taxes go to pay for these gangs who have secretaries and other expenses? Do we pay the General Motors lobbyist group? Well, yeah, we did in the bailout along with Chrysler. But that's not a general policy. If we don't pay special interest groups to have their lobbyists at the Capitol, why do we pay these gangs to do the same thing? For the presidential election, you'd obviously need to have multiple primaries of some sort. Maybe you'd start with regional primaries. You'd have to break the regions up based on population because naturally the eastern seaboard has more people than the mass of the Midwest, for example. But you could have two candidates coming out of each of eight regions of the country, then a national primary with 16 candidates from the regions, and out of that you could take the top four vote-getters to be on the national ballot. You could even have one of the four candidates endorsed by both parties, although the odds of that are slim to none because, for a strong portion of the Republicans, there's the litmus test of being anti-abortion. But no more would you see the corporations dominate at the two-party conventions where they don't really care who wins because they've paid off both. Right now, the candidate has to subject himself to the gang because if he or she opposes the gang, they won't endorse him or her in the next election. This makes the gang the power broker of who your choices are. The candidates have to swear allegiance to the gang first, the people second. As it stands, there are cases where the Bloods do something or the Crips do something, cases where they combine together, and cases where they pretend to work separately. Gang politics are a lot like pro wrestling when you think about it, where it's portrayed that the opponents are such adversaries. But ultimately, behind the scenes, it all comes down to good old boy clubs, just like the Senate, where it's a matter of how do we pull the wool over the eyes of the people and keep our cushy jobs. These guys are all multimillionaires coming out of office. I was working for $60,000 a year take-home when I was governor. No answer or solution is perfect. Everything can be abused, but ultimately, this brings it closer to the people. Nonpartisan elections are not some innovative new concept. I participated in one. In the city of Brooklyn Park, you might go in with 10 candidates in the primary for mayor, and then the top two vote-getters go forward into the general election in the fall. So I see this as a step towards winning back our country. The country isn't generally stolen by major events, but in essence by small incremental things that chip away at the foundation and the base and cause it to crumble. This is a great way where we could throw a huge trough of cement back on the base and restore some of the solidarity of the crumbling republic. Is it the whole answer? Shit, no, nothing ever is. Not when it's as big as the federal government, but it's something that could change course to where things might take a different turn. What the hell? Explain to me how this would be worse than what we've got. We're in a war today against the merger of corporate and state power. Fascism, as Mussolini defined it. The government still wants us to believe that you, the individual, have the say-so. That's the big lie. How much of the pie is actually left for us? The answer is very little. There are already some potentially good steps in the direction I'm pointing at. California voters have passed Proposition 14, which in primary elections puts candidates for every state and national office except president on the same ballot and lets a voter choose any one of them, no matter the party. Then the two candidates with the most votes face off in the November election, even if they're both from the same party. It's called a nonpartisan blanket primary, and a nickname I like, the jungle primary. Louisiana and Washington State, along with Alaska, have this in place as well. There's not even any voter party registration in Washington, and no signature requirements to get on the ballot. There's a prefers no new taxes party as well as a prefers salmon yoga party, for real, depending on which lotus flower you're sitting on. Instant runoff voting. IRV is a parallel deal that's been around a while. In fact, in Australia, IRV has been used for elections to their House of Representatives since 1919. Ireland uses IRV to elect its president and London for its mayor. Even here in the United States, Minneapolis, St. Paul, San Francisco, Oakland, and Portland, Maine have it in place for mayoral elections. And the Motion Picture Academy uses it to bring us the Best Picture Oscar every year. Sometimes it's called ranked choice voting, and here's how it works. It's one person, one vote. But out of however many candidates there are on the ballot, you rank them in order of your top three choices. Every ballot is counted for first choices first. If one candidate gets over half of those votes, he or she gets elected. If that doesn't happen, the last place candidate loses out, and you go to another round. Should your candidate be in the next round? Well and good. Otherwise, you pick among who's left. It keeps on going that way until somebody emerges victorious. When this process was used for the first time in a mayoral election in Portland, Maine, in November 2011, actually the first time their mayor hadn't been an appointed politician, it was an extremely competitive election. 15 candidates were in the running, and voter turnout was about 50% higher than had been predicted. In my view, IRV, by allowing multiple candidates, could possibly stop the parties from being the only two games in town. It won't eliminate money as a force, but the change that's needed is to break the grip of the two gangs. The group No Labels aims at a grassroots movement for independence. Its first convention took place in New York at the end of 2010, attended by New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, Florida Governor Charlie Crist, and some other big names among congresspeople. Their goal, they say, is a nonpartisan consensus on the big issues, a step at least in the right direction. But I'm more excited about the Occupy Wall Street movement that seems to scare the crap out of Bloomberg. I love this one. The protesters have even figured out how to turn high-tech tactics back on the cops. In New York, a fellow named Tim Poole acquired his own Parrot AR surveillance drone that he calls the Occucopter. It is a lightweight, four-rotor helicopter that you can buy cheaply on Amazon and control with your iPhone. It has an onboard camera so that you can view everything on your phone that it points at. Poole has modified the software to stream live video to the internet so that we can watch the action as it unfolds. He's looking to police-proof the device by trying to get a stable live feed so you can have 50 people controlling it in series, and even having another device so that the Occucopter could be remote-controlled from England. When the Republican Governors Association met in Florida last November, one of their chief strategists, Frank Luntz, said flat out that he was so scared of this anti-Wall Street effort, "I'm frightened to death." They're having an impact on what the American people think of capitalism. Heaven forfend, except he should have substituted plutocratic corporatism. Anyway, Luntz's advice was to replace the word capitalism in their speeches with economic freedom or free market and call the middle class hardworking taxpayers. Don't talk about jobs, say careers. Don't call it government spending, call it waste. Finally, be sure and tell the occupiers, "I get it. I get that you want to fix the system." I'm afraid all those people get is how to learn George Orwell's doublespeak. Wall Street can put Occupy down all it wants. One big hedge fund manager said, "Most people view it as a ragtag group looking for sex, drugs, and rock and roll." A veteran bank executive said, "It's not a middle-class uprising, it's fringe groups. It's people who have the time to do this." Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, said, "Most of our clients like us. If you have any great ideas, you guys can write them up and send them to me. We'll take them into consideration." Well, right off, that kind of considered attitude is just what has so many of the 99% closer to storming the Bastille than any time, certainly in my lifetime. Not only students, but also unions are getting involved, and even a few courageous cops have crossed the barricade line. Now there's InterOccupy, an elaborate website with multiple weekly phone calls during which occupiers trade ideas, coordinate multi-state actions, and plan for the future. Folks from about 150 occupations around the United States have taken part in these and led to shutting down ports on the West Coast, for one. It was heartening to see, in January 2012, the OWS movement join with the National Prison Divestment Campaign for actions in 13 cities. The divestment refers to the private prison industry and the role of big financial institutions like Wells Fargo and Bank of America. Yep, the same people involved in totally screwing our economy are busy investing in putting more Americans behind bars. Wells Fargo, as it happens, owns 3.5 million shares in GEO Group after the Corrections Corporation of America, see Chapter 5, the biggest private prison operator in the country. At one of the actions, it got revealed that the detaining of immigrants is a goldmine for these companies. Since the Department of Homeland Security took over immigration enforcement in 2003, the number of immigrants detained each year has almost doubled to 390,000. Today, nearly 50% of all federally detained immigrants are housed in private prisons. Also, let's hear it for the new non-corporatized media. I'm talking about the coming together of WikiLeaks and Anonymous, which will not only reveal more hacked truths that government doesn't want us to know about, but force the mass media to pay attention or get seen for the spineless gang supporters they really are. Thousands of people are starting to realize that what politicians want us to do is sign up for their propaganda packages, which only reflect the will of their lobbyist paymasters. To get our unconditional endorsement, they talk down to us, scare us, lie to us with claptrap solutions to the nation's problems, and until now their manipulations have worked quite effectively, especially in conjunction with the deballing of the media. Are we really only card-carrying Reds, Blues, Greens, Tees, Mavericks, Liberals, Traitors, Terrorists, Communists? I'm sorry, but any form of unquestioning allegiance is nothing more than life on autopilot. We are constantly asked to cancel our individual thinking, questioning, and demanding by the very people who are supposed to be encouraging it. Contributing to the national dumbdown is the appeal to laziness and accepting screeds of prejudice, bombast, and manipulation as neatly packaged thought. Why should politicians be accountable to a populace whom they've lulled into passivity? They just go on shilling for their true masters of the universe, the oil companies, banks, military contractors, pharmaceutical and insurance giants, and so on. If you can't lug a bag of cash down K Street, you're shit out of luck. I found this summation by Alison Stanger, author of One Nation Under Contract, to sum up the situation pretty clearly. Money's conquest of American politics has therefore rendered impotent the well-worn prescriptions of the left and the right, which now deliver only scapegoats rather than solutions. This is because the terms of political engagement have shifted dramatically over the past two decades. In the 20th century, big government was by definition bureaucratic government. Today, government can be big in terms of spending while handing all its work over to contractors. In the 20th century, business and government were adversaries. Today, the wall between the two that may have once existed has become a revolving door, and both share common interests. Neither liberal nor conservative visions of good government can be realized so long as government itself is for sale. Here's another idea that's recently surfaced. Force the Federal Communications Commission to stop TV broadcast outlets from charging for campaign ads. That would go a long way toward ending this super PAC bullshit. Way back in the Communications Act of 1934, Congress, under FDR, established the general requirement that broadcasters must act in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. That idea of the media as public trustee is something that actually got upheld by the Supreme Court. So let's occupy the FCC. It's going to take a whole lot of detailed, nuanced thinking and action to get us out of this mess. First, we must make politicians understand that we aren't going to rubber stamp their actions anymore based on lies. And if they try to make suckers out of us, they must understand that we're going to turn them out on their heads, if not on a rail or a pole. We won't be dumbed down, manipulated, or sold out anymore. Those days are coming to an end. It's our turn. We the people, e pluribus unum, let's panic the party animals and the plutocrats. Let's take our country back. Just get up off the ground, that's all I ask. Get up there with that lady that's up on top of this Capitol dome, that lady that stands for liberty. Take a look at this country through her eyes if you really want to see something. And you won't just see scenery. You'll see the whole parade of what man's carved out for himself after centuries of fighting. Fighting for something better than just jungle law. Fighting so as he can stand on his own two feet, free and decent, like he was created, no matter what his race, color, or creed. That's what you'd see. There's no place out there for graft or greed or lies or compromise with human liberties. Great principles don't get lost once they come to light. They're right here. You just have to see them again. Jefferson Smith, in the movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, 1939. This concludes Democrips and Rebloodlicans. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers, or call toll-free 877-TANTOR to request a catalog.